from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. No one ever said American politics was patty cake, but this year's presidential election is turning out to be the roughest, toughest, and muddiest in years. In this hour, we will ask why, where it's pushing the election contest, and how the mud looks through the eyes of history. Tonight on Point, Brass Knuckle Politics 2004, what they mean for the parties and what they say about the country. We begin tonight with the latest numbers on the race for the White House. Frank Newport is editor-in-chief of the Gallup Poll and joins us from Pennington, New Jersey. Frank, thanks for being with us again.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
So here we are. It's rolling on. There's going to be a winner. The brawl is well underway. What do the polls look like this week, Frank?
Well, there wasn't necessarily a winner right off the bat in 2000, so we'll wait and see. Kerry's ahead. There's no question about that.
John Kerry's ahead?
Mm-hmm. John Kerry is ahead nationally. Our poll showed him with 7 points of – excuse me. I have misspoken myself, and I hope that Bush is ahead.
Right there.
I don't know why. I'm glad you paused there. Bush is ahead, what I meant to say, by 7 points. Bush 52, Kerry 45.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, there have been over 10 national polls conducted in the last week or so, and in none of them is Kerry ahead. So there's no question that Bush came out of the Republican convention the night of August with at least a slight lead over his opponent, John Kerry.
John Kerry supporters charged throughout August that the attack of the Swift Boat veterans opposed to him seriously hurt his campaign. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot in the papers and in the electronic media about George Bush's National Guard record during the Vietnam War. Does that appear to have hurt him at all?
Well, it's a little hard to tell or to establish causality because, you know, events happen and then the poll may change in terms of our trial heat ballot and you don't know exactly what's happening. I believe Kerry was first and foremost hurt by his own convention, or at least not helped. That was a dud. There's no question about it. The Swift Boat ads, if they didn't hurt him, certainly didn't help him. And then Bush gained a few points through his convention. A little early to tell now if the last few days' focus on Bush's National Guard service and the CBS documents and all of that is going to have any lasting impact.
And again, as you say, causality is hard to establish, but the images and news from Iraq have been downright awful this week. Can you see any impact from that, or do you anticipate it?
I would not necessarily anticipate impact. People called because they said there is a symbolic significance to the 1,000th American being killed there, but we have seen many reports over the last 6 months, even a year, of American deaths and bombs blowing up and terrorist activity and insurgent activity in Iraq, and it doesn't seem to have strongly affected the numbers. In fact, the opposition to Iraq in our numbers actually crested in June and early July and has come down a little since that point. So anything can happen, and maybe there will be kind of a cumulative effect, but at least to date, we're not finding that Iraq is having a deleterious impact on Bush's positioning in the polls.
So 52-45 for Bush in the overall contest right now. What other metrics, what other questions have you asked that we might be interested in that might shed light on this moment in the race, Frank Newport?
Well, there's no question that Bush's signature strength is his handling of terrorism and his position as a leader. That came through after his convention, and in fact, that's where Kerry took a hit in our data. Kerry's unfavorables went up slightly in his position. Do you think John Kerry could serve adequately as commander-in-chief of the military? Dropped, and he's now deficient on that measure compared to Bush. So the themes that the Republicans hit at their convention, that is the war on terrorism, the fact that America's at war and that Bush is the leader we need and that Kerry's not, seem to have come through at least to enough voters to move our numbers at this point. Now, I should point out at the same time we are tracking a lot of states. And they're looking fascinating. They're different. You know, in some states like Ohio, Bush has moved ahead, and he has moved ahead in Wisconsin. But in other states, like Pennsylvania, he's not. It's still dead tied there. In what many people consider to be a swing state like Washington State, Kerry still has a lead. So we're not seeing just the massive movement to Bush in all the swing states, and, of course, that's what matters.
And after all the negative reports and reporting in recent weeks, what about the trustworthiness measure with these two candidates? How does that stand now, Frank Newport?
Well, Bush is slightly better on that than is John Kerry. But we'll wait and see. As I mentioned before, with the current focus on Bush's National Guard service, we're going to see if anything more comes out of that. I would point out that Bush and his National Guard service have been the focus of news reports in the past, And I don't believe this is not speaking necessarily from the data as much as from my own feel, having looked at the data for 3.5 years on Bush, that the public saying, we already know, he was a goof-up as a young man. That's probably not going to startlingly change their perception of him any more than it changed perceptions of Clinton when he was once again seen as womanizing. The public said, well, we knew that from day one. Give us something new.
Give us something new. Well, undoubtedly, something new will come down the pike. But for right now, 52-45 for Bush in the polls. Frank Newport, thanks very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of the Gallup Poll. He spoke with me from Pennington, New Jersey. Some say it's the unprecedented amount of cash flooding the contest. Some say it's ubiquitous new technologies. Some say it's the passion of a wounded nation at war. Whatever the reason, this year's presidential campaign season is rougher and dirtier than Americans have seen in years. From swift boat attack ads to allegations of forged National Guard memos, it's a hard world out there where big issues can get shortchanged in the brawl. This hour on Point, we are talking about negative campaigns, where they come from, where they lead, and what they mean for democracy and for this year's vote. How would you characterize this year's presidential politics? Have you seen worse? Does the country deserve better? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Syracuse, New York, is Andrew Robertson. He's associate professor of history at Lehman College and the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. Andrew Robertson, good evening and welcome. Great to have you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Andrew Robertson, we have all looked around and listened and seen what's been going on in recent months. Here's a headline from the Washington Post in May of this year. It says, from Bush, unprecedented negativity, scholars say campaign is making history with often misleading attacks. And that's in May, and a lot more has come down the pike from both sides in this campaign since then. You know the history of presidential campaigns and campaigning. Tell us, how do you see this in the context of history? Are we out of bounds here? Or are we well within the margin?
Well, I think we're still within the margins. There's nothing new about negative campaigning. You can go all the way back to the election of 1800 and see negative tactics that we haven't seen resorted to yet in this campaign. For example, the Federalists who were supporting John Adams in that campaign warned that if Thomas Jefferson were elected president, and they accused him of being an atheist, God would wreak vengeance on the United States. People were worried enough in Connecticut that they buried their Bibles because they feared that if Thomas Jefferson were elected, he would set up Jacobin councils in every town in Connecticut and behead all the good God-fearing Christians. So that's just one example. Just to take the same era, there were accusations of cowardice and even of Jefferson's impotence, as well as, of course, the famous allegations that have now we've learned were true about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. So these kinds of negative allegations are not unusual at all. In this particular campaign, though, we're seeing a lot of personal attacks, and that is somewhat more unusual. Negative campaigning, after all, can be very useful in a political contest. Kathleen Hall Jamieson, for one, has pointed out that negative contrasts in policy are the ways a very valuable tool that voters use to make up their minds about which side they're going to support. But personal attacks often get in the way. The conventional wisdom is that personal attacks only occur when we have nothing else to talk about. That was the conventional wisdom in the year 2000. But this campaign, we have a great deal to debate. A war, an uncertain economy, medical care. And we really, some of these personal attacks now are serving as a distraction.
Let me ask you this. You say there's always been negativity in American politics, and yet when we look back at the presidential elections, going back quite a few years now, it's hard to remember any with quite this intensity. Is there an ebb and flow to negativity in American presidential campaigns? Does it come and go in different eras, and why?
Absolutely. It waxes and wanes. And I believe that part of the trend is the result of new technology being introduced into the warfare of politics. When you think about political rhetoric is really another kind of warfare. And new technology tends to destabilize the rhetorical conflict just as new technology destabilizes military conflict.
Now, what do you mean by that? How?
Well, if you think about the introduction of the Internet, for example, that has created a whole new network of communications at the bottom level for grassroots participants and for contributors of scurrilous scandals to make their way up the communications food chain until it's broadcast in the national broadcast network news.
But of course, that's not new in 2004. We had the Internet in 2000. We had the rudiments of it in 96, I guess.
Right, but it just as with military technology, you have to see the implementation of this technology and effective use in the conflict. And this is very similar to what you see, say, in the early 19th century with the introduction of the newspaper communications revolution. All of a sudden in the early 1800s, you see a tremendous explosion in the number of newspapers.
Instead of pamphlets, you've got suddenly printing presses churning it out.
That's right. Every town in Massachusetts has its own daily. And suddenly you see, as we do today, there's a news hole and people need to cover news. And all of a sudden they're manufacturing scandal. They're looking for new ways to look at the candidates and personal information becomes very valuable.
So technology may be a factor. What else, Andrew Robinson?
Well, very important in this particular campaign is the use of recurrent themes. For example, you see we go back to old themes to understand something about character. Character has become important because I think now we see a kind of false sense of intimacy with these personalities. We're really, in that way, we see a kind of parallel with the 1700s. We have a kind of celebrity politics now, and we believe that we are very close to these candidates because we see them up close. Mm-hmm. So we think that personality matters a great deal. For example, now the war conduct is seen as very salient. And this is something that you see in the early 19th century as well. People were still discussing the conduct of Jefferson in the Revolutionary War. He retreated out of Richmond at the time the British occupied the Virginia State Capitol. They were talking about that 30 years later.
Jack Beatty, join us here before we get to the break. A lot of history of mud flying in American politics, and yet when you're in the midst of any individual presidential campaign season, it seems very relevant and usually quite unfortunate.
Yes, but, you know, I think there's a sort of idea of progress we have, that, you know, we're past the kinds of egregious things in the past. And let me just give you an illustration of the more things change, the more they remain the same. In 1950, George Smathers was running against Claude Pepper, the Senate seat in Florida, and he was campaigning in rural Florida. And he would go before these rural farmers, their wives, and he would say, "Do you know that my opponent is married to a thespian?" "And do you know that he has had a monogamous relationship with her for 30 years?" And the farmers quickly, you know, block
Good
the
Lord,
ears
Betty.
Of their wives. "Don't listen to him. Oh, my gosh, my thespian. Oh, my gosh." You'd say, "Well, I mean, that's because they were ignorant." Well, look at Dick Cheney. He and the entire Republican apparat attacks John Kerry for voting against all these weapon systems. And it turns out Cheney, as Secretary of Defense, wanted them, or most of them, eliminated himself. So, in other words, he is treating us, Cheney, just the way George Smathers was those gallus snapping farmers, that we're the kind of people you can go thespians and we go, "Oh, geez."
So the charge may be true, but the context is unperceived.
That's right. And the attribution to the public that you are stupid and I'll treat you as if you're stupid. There's no progress in that respect. We're all saying, "Boy, John Kerry, he voted against all those weapon systems."
Hold the thought right there. Jack Beatty, Andrew Robinson, we have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about brass knuckle politics, 04, the negative, the dirty, the tough, the demagoguing, and the downright ugly. You can join the conversation tonight. Is this campaign dirtier, tougher, uglier than in years past? Are you disgusted by the level of vitriol and mud? Are you swayed by it? Is it naive to complain about hardball politics given this country's history, or do you believe the country deserves, needs better? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about brass knuckle politics. 04. You can join the conversation tonight. Is this campaign season dirtier, tougher, uglier than in years past? And if it is, why? With what effect? What impact? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty is with us tonight. We're also joined by Andrew Robertson, Associate Professor of History at Lehman College and at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. He's author of The Language of Democracy, which looks at 18th century campaigning. We're joined now from New Jersey by Jonathan Alter, senior editor and columnist at Newsweek. He writes the Between the Lines column for Newsweek magazine. He's covered the past five presidential elections. He's co-author of Selecting a President. Jonathan Alter, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
Jonathan, you've written about election issues and or real issues and campaign issues. And the campaign issues, as you described them this year, pretty tough, pretty ugly.
Well, you know, I'm afraid this is one of those cases where I sound like a broken record, because every 4 years I try to draw this distinction between campaign issues and real issues. Campaign issues aren't always mudslinging, but they're things that are manufactured to score points off of an opponent, and they are usually blown out of proportion by both the candidates and by the media, but they don't really have anything to do with what the candidates would actually be like in the White House. And I draw a distinction between those campaign issues and what I call, you know, maybe somewhat naively, real issues, which are things that a president can actually do something about, that would actually face a president on his first day in office, and that his views on are important. But often they're not very sexy. They don't lend themselves to television. They don't lend themselves to bashing the other guy over the head with. And so the real issues get ignored. And the big examples this year for me are things like nuclear terrorism and some other questions that about Iraq. Did the war in Iraq make us safer or less safe? That you would think would be at the center of the debate, but actually are not getting very much airtime.
So, Jonathan, let me ask you. I mean, we talk about those, what you would call real issues, every night of the week here. But at some point, the negative campaigning itself would appear to become a real issue when you step back and look at it. As you said, you've covered five campaigns. When we were ticking them off, just going backwards in our mind here, it seemed like a while since we've seen one this down and dirty. Correct us if we're wrong, but if you look back at Clinton and Dole, seemed like kind of sandbox play by comparison. Clinton and Bush, Bush won and Dukakis, yeah, there was some tough stuff there, but did it really compare? And then Reagan, hasn't it been a while since we've seen this level of intensity of the tough stuff?
I think we saw this in 1988 when it was Dukakis against Bush.
Willie Horton and all that.
And not just Willie Horton, but you remember that basically the point of the Bush campaign was to say that Dukakis lacked patriotism. And that's a pretty rough charge. You know, the whole subtext of the Pledge of Allegiance issue that the Bush campaign raised.
Right, the flag burning.
They raised a flag burning. They campaigned at flag factories. They said that Dukakis couldn't be trusted, was unfit to be trusted with the nation's defense, with that Snoopy in the tank ad. And, of course, Willie Horton, which was not done by the Bush campaign as such, but was a sort of an early version of a 527. It was an independent ad. But I think that was pretty rough. Dukakis did not fight back well. And then at the end, the one that Dukakis remembers the most, but is actually not well remembered by most other people, is something that Ronald Reagan, who was then president, took part in and was so far below the belt it's almost unbelievable, and that was the idea that Dukakis might be mentally ill, which Reagan was asked about. Instead of saying that's ridiculous to this planted question, he actually gave it credence. He gave a kind of a flip answer that let the story play through the media, even though there was no basis to it whatsoever.
Jack Beatty, what's your sense, looking back on elections? How long has it been since we've had one this tough? Would you put 88 up in the class of 2004, or do we have to go back to, I don't know, Nixon, Johnson?
Well, the man running this year's negative campaign, which is really, I mean, the Washington Post said 75% of Bush's ads are negative. The man in charge of that, it was the protege of the guy who did 1988, Lee Atwater. Mm-hmm. And he has learned. And not only has he learned, he's given a Texas twist, which is a kind of barbed wire covering to campaigns. Karl Rove destroys the people he's running against. That's how he does it. He has a president who I don't think has a record to run on. It just doesn't seem to me that if you have the worst record on jobs since Hoover, that if you've got an unnecessary war, it's hard to argue this is a great record. So what does he do? He just tears down the other guy, and this guy is a past master at it. So I think a lot of this is the lengthened shadow and the rather nasty one of Karl Rove.
Andrew Robertson, come in on this. How far back do you look to find a comparably tough campaign?
I think you might even have to go back as far as 1884, which is the famous Grover Cleveland, James G. Blaine campaign. This is the one, Ma, Ma, Where's My Pa, gone to the White House, ha, ha, ha. Grover Cleveland had fathered an illegitimate child, and he was accused by the Republicans of profligacy and promiscuity. Of course, this is the Victorian era.
Right.
It was also a time when the Republicans referred to the Democratic Party as the party of rum, Romanism, and rebellion, which it was a three-way attack on drinking, Catholicism, and Southern supporters of the Confederacy.
Mm-hmm. So,
1884, that's a long way back. Jonathan Alter, I hear you there.
I defer to my colleagues on some of the history, but I think there have been some really nasty ones since then that have been lost a little in the mists of time. In 1920, for instance, the Democrats spread a rumor that Warren Harding, who won the election, was part black, which at the time was a pretty harsh thing to say. The 1964 campaign, Lyndon Johnson, the famous Daisy ad, suggested that if Barry Goldwater were elected, it would lead to nuclear war. So, you know, there's a pretty steady history of this kind of thing. My sense, though, is that those two examples, notwithstanding, that particularly in the last 50 years or so, that Republicans have been much, much better at the black arts of politics than Democrats. And I welcome the thoughts of all of you on why that is. But one possible explanation is that you've had three families, three political figures plus one son, who have been on every Republican ticket since 1952, with the exception with only one exception, 1964.
And by that you mean?
Nixon, Dole, Bush. Every single Republican ticket has had Nixon, Dole, or a Bush since 1952. That's more than 50 years, except for that election I just mentioned, 1964, when the Democrats were rougher. And I don't think it's any coincidence, because these three gentlemen, plus Bush's son, are all very well practiced in the art of negative campaigning. We just saw it again with Bob Dole when he gave the Swift Boat ads more credence. We can stipulate Nixon's contributions. And the Bush family, I think Maureen Dowd calls them the WASP Corleones, but they play the game very, very rough, and they've been on a lot of tickets in recent years.
I want to look at this issue of which party plays the rough game better. The polls would seem, if that's what's driving it, to suggest right now that the GOP is doing pretty well with it. But let me bring the callers in here first, just for a moment. Tammy's calling from Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi, Tammy. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have one comment to make about the statement that your friend there just made. If you go back and you research long, long, long time ago, either the candidates themselves or key people in their campaigns were fraternity brothers, and they're still very, very close, and they were all into sports and other things. I mean, maybe that's why they all play the same game.
Did you say the Kennedy brothers?
No, candidates. I said they were fraternity brothers.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So the old skull and bones connection here. But what's your bigger thought on what's going on, Tammy?
Well, I really think that the average American and people that I have business in three different states
Yeah.
And I deal with military every single day, and the people that I talk to are just fed up with the negativity. And mm-hmm. what I'm finding nationwide is that the campaign issues are just should not be the issues that a presidential race is based on. You know, gay marriage and abortion and some of the other issues are not, in my opinion, they should not be raised or brought up or fought over in a presidential campaign. That has nothing to do with the everyday American's life nor the way that we function in business. So, and my opinion as far as negativity, it seems to me that every race that a Bush has been involved in brings up the patriotism of it's the candidate, his candidate, her candidate, whoever
right,
it is.
Okay.
And go back even to the governor races, you go back to Texas, Florida, they do the same thing.
So you say, let's get it down to the things that really matter to me and not take it off into the weeds here. Tammy, thanks very much for your call. I want to pick up this issue of Republicans versus Democrats here because it seems to really matter this year. Andrew Robertson, historically, we just heard Jonathan Alter's kind of thesis here. You've had a sure. Nixon, a Dole, or a Bush in the GOP ticket for a long time, and maybe there's a kind of accumulated wisdom in what he calls the black arts or competence anyway. But have the two parties, there seems to be a kind of a gap in competence on the bare-knuckle side this year. Is that of long standing? Is that of recent vintage?
I think it is of long standing. You know, it's interesting that this may be one of the key features of dynastic politics. In the 1700s, they would speak about someone as a scion of a long-tailed family. But the fact is that families have family styles. And, you know, the Corleone family has a particular style of doing battle. And so do the Bush family. So did the Kennedys. I mean, there's a certain kind of conflictual style that people bring to politics. But the interesting thing here, I think, that's developed over the last decade is the Republican network, which really goes right from the grassroots all the way up to the broadcast news. They've developed a very sophisticated network, and it really is incumbent on the Democrats now to match this network. There's a kind of asymmetry. The Republicans have dominate the blogosphere. They are able to generate rumors and ideas from the bottom, which are then picked up on 24-hour cable networks. These are then fed to Fox News, and from Fox News, they're broadcast into the print media and into the other broadcast news outlets.
So there's a kind of network that's really working there. I want to turn quickly to Tempe, Arizona, where we're joined by Kevin Dooley. He's professor of supply chain management at Arizona State University. He's creator of the Mud Meter and co-founder of Crawdad Technologies. Kevin Dooley, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
So we can go on the web any day and look at your Crawdad campaign dashboard, including the Mud Meter there, and get your assessment of how the Kerry and Bush campaigns are operating over it all, and in particular on this mud factor. How do you measure? How do they stand up to one another?
Well, our computer reads the blogs and the official website material that both campaigns put out, and it does the diagramming of sentences just like we all did in grade school. And from understanding the grammar that are being used, it identifies words and how they connect to one another. And the way that we measure mud is that we look for sentences that each use to explain or comment on the other candidate. And then we have a large list of words in a dictionary that have both a negative and positive sense.
Now, I'm looking at what you call the influential word usage out of that. You've got both candidates using the word leadership, maybe above all, but they do go after each other. John Kerry on Bush, among his most frequently used words, dirty, nasty, negative. Bush on Kerry, dubious, false, untruth, cheap. I mean, this is tough stuff.
No holds barred there.
But what do you find in terms of the dynamic of, is there a volume difference? Is there an intensity difference between the two campaigns on the mud side?
Well, what we see in terms of mudslinging is that, especially since the end of the Republican convention, that Bush's mud meter has gone to levels that we haven't seen over the past 3 months. So actually, over a whole 3-month period, John Kerry's communications have actually been a little bit muddier in that they've used more negative words when talking about President Bush. But especially since the end of the Republican convention, that trend has turned around.
But when I look at your dashboard here, another interesting thing, it seems to me that you're indicating that Kerry, the intensity of Kerry's language in attack seems to kind of track George Bush's. When Bush's rises, Kerry's follows it up. Have I got that right?
That's right. And intensity basically measures, in a way, how emotional the communications are. And we've seen over this three-month period that, in general, the Kerry communications have been more emotional and intense, and Bush's communications have been less emotional and more factual.
But who's calling the tune here in terms of intensity, then? Is John Kerry setting the tone of this race? It doesn't feel that way very often.
No, we see patterns across intensity and tone and mud-throwing in terms of Bush's campaign being much more constant over this 2 to 3 month period, whereas Kerry's have been much more erratic and appear to follow certain trends in Bush's communication. And so, for example, when Bush throws more mud, we see a subtle pattern that several days later, Kerry's communications gained focus.
So there it is, the crawdad mud meter. Kevin Dooley, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Jack Beattie, you hear it right there, kind of word analysis of both campaigns. And there's this funny combination, lots of intensity in both, but Kerry sort of following the Bush lead.
Yes, and, you know, imagine, let's turn things around. Suppose John Kerry were the incumbent president and 9/11 had happened on his watch. Can you imagine how Karl Rove would use that issue against him? We don't hear that from John Kerry. If he's raised 9/11 and Bush's competence and the failure up and down the line, I haven't heard it. And really, that's allowed Bush to maintain this sort of picture of himself as the I was presidentialized by 9/11. I found my mission. It was a great moment because we all came together. Well, there's a whole train of evidence of incompetence and worse, sometimes just almost willful incompetence, as in the case of John Ashcroft, in this administration that Kerry could be hanging him with, and he's not doing it.
Jonathan Alter, we just got a few seconds before the break, but Bill Clinton was fried and roasted over Lewinsky and Whitewater. They seem minute issues now compared to those Jack's raising, 9/11, war, and all the rest. Is Bush getting a pass somehow? Do the Democrats not have the killer instinct?
I think on some level they don't. They either go overboard, so some surrogates and, you know, the Michael Moores of the world don't do the Democrats any favors by just saying liar, liar, pants on fire, because that's not very artful. And yet on some of the big issues like where's Bin Laden, where are the Democrats? You know, why aren't they saying, you said dead or alive, we don't have them either dead or alive? They're lacking some sort of killer instinct here, I think partly because they think that there's a price to be paid for negative advertising and negative attacks, which everybody says in focus groups. Voters all claim that they don't like negative attacks, but they work. And I don't really think politicians do pay much of a price for it. In that sense, the Democrats have been subjected to, brought into a fallacy.
Maybe lost a step. Jonathan Alter, Andrew Robertson, Jack, stand by. We're talking about brass knuckle politics, 04. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about brass knuckle politics 2004. You can join the conversation. Is there any doubt that the GOP plays this rough game better? And why? And what's fair? And what is unfair, finally? Where's the line between rough and dirty, despicable, destructive? When does political hardball prove a candidate's chops? And when is it destructive to democracy? Are we there? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Syracuse, New York, by Andrew Robertson, author of The Language of Democracy. From New Jersey, by Jonathan Alter, senior editor and columnist at Newsweek, and our own Jack Beattie. Ariana is calling right now from Boston. Hi, Ariana. You're on the air.
Hello. One of the points I wanted to make is it seems like in the group of people who I speak to who do support Bush, a lot of them seem to take all of his attacks as absolute facts. Kerry is a liar. And yet, the Kerry campaign never brings up the many, many contradictions within the Bush White House. I feel like they should be defending themselves more aggressively and going after his record far more aggressively than they are.
But, of course, they've criticized the Bush White House. Why do you think that doesn't stick or doesn't amount to the same intensity? Do you think it doesn't?
I think it absolutely doesn't. These people don't realize or are not getting the message at all. When I speak to these people and point out this stuff, they act as if they've never heard it. So it doesn't seem like any of Kerry's either defense or attacks are getting to people's ears.
Ariana, thanks for the call. It's an interesting point. I mean, Jack, it's not as though there haven't been attacks and widely observed ones. I mean, take Michael Moore, you know, biggest selling documentary in history, $100 million worth of box office. That's a lot of eyeballs on the screen. And yet, you just hear it in Ariana's call, there's this feeling that somehow the Republicans are better at that down-and-dirty headlock. What is it about Democrats?
Well, I think part of it, I mean, I think John is right that, I mean, they just, there's a killer instinct they don't have. I mean, one continuity in Democratic campaigns, of course, has been Bob Schrum. He's kind of a mortician of campaigns, really. He's lost pretty much everyone he's had to do with, and he's doing his worst on this one, it seems to me. And that's why we got this new team. But, you know, Ariana raised another point there, which is, it was the first time these people had heard it, had heard that things Bush said were not so. That says a lot about our media, you know. And I think the Democrats really depend on the media to say, folks, this isn't fair. This is false, right? You point it out. And it doesn't work that way anymore. I mean, you know, you can say anything on television, and Jim Lehrer turns to the other fellow and he says, well, now for the other side, Hitler, what do you say? Are you really as bad as all that? Well, no, I'm not as bad as all that, Jim. In other words, the conventions of journalism, that there's one side and there's the other side, geld the truth-finding function of journalism, and they leave... And the Democrats are just foolish to think that the press is going to correct all this.
Jonathan Alter, you're part of that press, so am I. But what do you think about that? Is it a search for balance that's not leaving people in the right place? I mean, on the other hand, there's half the country, more now if the polls are right, that support George Bush. They've got a perspective that deserves some respect.
Well, there is such a thing as what you could call phony balance, where you fall prey to these conventions of journalism that are at odds with the truth. In other words, our obligation, and I think we, you know, certainly we try, at least those of us in some news organizations, you know, we try to get at the truth, but our obligation is not to provide a phony balance. It's to get at the truth. And sometimes that's going to make people mad, and we make people on both sides really mad in Newsweek on an almost a weekly basis by the stories that we have. But you can't, you know, just do stories that are critical of Bush and not do stories that are critical of Kerry, then you really, then you're no longer a journalist.
But if a party cannot depend on the press to sort all this out, then some appear to emerge as better than others at defending themselves.
Well, that is foolish of the parties to depend on the press to sort it out. They need to, John Kerry's problem, in my mind, is not that he's not being critical at all of George Bush. He is, but he's not doing it in a sticky way. There was a great book called The Tipping Point by Malcolm Gladwell a few years ago, and he had a chapter where he talked about stickiness, how certain ideas in the culture stick. And Kerry has not done a good job of framing the issues in memorable ways with little catchphrases that stick in the mind. He finally got one last week where he said W stands for wrong, and at least that's something that people can remember. But that's really the first one in months.
And even that doesn't seem quite as two-fisted, quite as visceral in its connection. Andrew Robertson, what do you make of it?
Well, I think what we're seeing now is that Kerry is finally responding. But, you know, part of this is really a measure of something that's very valuable in a president. Richard Neustadt has pointed out many years ago that the power of the presidency is the power to persuade.
Mm-hmm.
An American candidate for president has to be able to persuade people. And so in the midst of all these personal slimy attacks, you know, there really is a criterion that we're measuring here. Is this man going to be able to persuade us? Can he react quickly? Can he turn a campaign around? Is he a strategic thinker? These are all important aspects of the presidency. And
even
no
connecting viscerally with a great audience, with a great
electorate. Absolutely. All the great presidents have been rhetorical innovators. There's no question about that. You look at Lincoln, you look at Wilson to some extent, FDR certainly, John Kennedy. Had he had a second term, perhaps he would have had an opportunity to use those rhetorical gifts. It is certainly true that a president who uses those gifts connects, and that really is a prerequisite for greatness.
Yet the way the gifts are used really matters. Jack Beattie, where do you think we're going to end up this campaign season after all the mud that has flown?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of feeling of, was the election fought on the real reasons, or were they all, as John said, campaign issues, manufactured, the modern, the 2004 version of the Pledge of Allegiance and the Flag Factory.
What fools we will feel if it feels that way when it's all over, given what confronts us in this world.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to give the election a feeling of illegitimacy no matter how it comes out.
Jonathan Alter, final thought.
Well, I think maybe I'm Pollyannish, but I have a sense that when the debates come around, we will get to some of the real issues, because there are a lot of the trappings of nastiness are kind of stripped away. They have to face each other and talk about something real. But what worries me is that I do think that the conservatives have an unfair advantage in the spin after the debates. If you look at what happened the last time, and that no matter what happens in the debate, this echo chamber, this elephant echo chamber of blogs and talk radio and cable TV will spin the debate results toward Bush.
Well, stay tuned and keep your guard up. Jonathan Alter at Newsweek, thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
And Andrew Robertson, author of The Language of Democracy, wonderful to have you on tonight. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
And Jack, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org in a moment. A look at Kitty Kelly's controversial new biography of the Bush family. This is On Point. Controversial celebrity biographer Kitty Kelly entered the election year fray today with the release of her new book, The Family, The Real Story of the Bush Dynasty. It's a generally unflattering portrayal of the Bush family, complete with steamy charges of drugs and sex that have become Kitty Kelly's trademark in previous unauthorized biographies of Nancy Reagan, the British royal family, and others. The White House has called the book's allegations false and has raised questions about Kelly's sourcing. Still, the book is at number one on both Amazon and BarnesandNoble.com. Kathleen Kiley is a reporter for USA Today who has read the tabloid bio. I asked her which of Kitty Kelly's allegations are making the most waves in Washington.
The story that's making the biggest buzz is the one that involves the sitting president. This book is obviously about the entire Bush family, and it goes back to the origins of the Klan at the beginning of the century. I think most people are focused on the charges that involve this President Bush, and Kitty Kelly makes an assertion in the book that's quite controversial that President Bush was witnessed imbibing cocaine at Camp David while his father was president, which would put this incident well past the date in which President Bush has indicated he turned over a new leaf. You know, he has never said one way or another whether he used drugs. He's kind of been coy about that. He did admit to having had a drinking problem, and he said he quit drinking when he was 40 years old. Well, if this happened while his father was president, it would be significantly later than that. And so it's raised a lot of skepticism, and there's been a lot of examination of Kitty Kelly's sourcing, which I have to say would not meet the sourcing standards of most daily newspapers. I mean, we would not feel comfortable, I think, here with the sourcing that she has printing that story. So if that puts it in perspective, that's kind of where we are. But it has certainly made the news, and it's been debated on national TV, and I'm sure it's being buzzed around the blogosphere today.
And it gets layer on layer with this cocaine use charge with Sharon Bush, the former wife of President Bush's brother, Neil, cited in the book as supporting this cocaine use allegation, and Sharon Bush now herself denying she ever said it.
There's two aspects of this. One is that Sharon Bush says that she never confirmed this story. Now, there is a witness to the lunch between Sharon Bush and Kitty Kelly who confirms Kitty Kelly's story, says that Sharon Bush did indeed tell Kitty Kelly that she was aware of this having happened at Camp David. But I have to say that the bottom line is, no matter who you believe, both sides are saying that Sharon Bush was not an eyewitness, that right. Even if Sharon Bush did confirm this, she wasn't confirming something that she had eyewitnessed. She was confirming something that she had heard about. So it is really a hearsay witness. Now, Kitty Kelly says that she has another source for this story, and so she felt comfortable going with it. So there's layers of controversy here. There's a question about, A, did Sharon Bush tell her this? And B, even if she did, does it matter? Because neither Sharon Bush nor Kitty Kelly is saying that she ever eyewitnessed anything.
Apart from the particular allegations, Kitty Kelly's written up some very prominent families, the Reagans, the Royals in the U.K. What's the broad characterization of the Bush family that Kelly delivers in this sort of century-long sweep?
It's primarily a negative view of the family. I mean, I have to say I've read the book, and there are some high points, I think, for the family in there. But I think Kitty herself has acknowledged that this is pretty much of a negative view. I think the main characterization is a family that started the century with wealth and power. Both of the president's great-grandfathers were connected to major industrialists of the age, and then levered their connections and their money into more connections and money. So it's a story about a family climbing a ladder of wealth and power in sometimes ways that Kitty Kelly characterizes as sometimes ruthless and sometimes unfair. It's not a completely negative portrayal, but I would say it's largely a negative portrayal.
733 pages, that's a lot of stuff. Do people take Kitty Kelly seriously? Do they take the impact of her books seriously, even now, right in the teeth of a presidential campaign?
Kitty is what she's often called a celebrity biographer. So I think, you know, she's not viewed in the category of, say, a heavyweight historian. But I have to say, as a reporter myself, you have to be impressed by her research. I mean, this is not pure fluff. She has gone back to court records, to congressional records. She's gone to, well, libraries, historical societies. So she's done a whole lot of research. That is very typical of her books. But I think the things that make the headlines and perhaps sell the books might be the weakest link. I mean, if you look at some of the more sensational charges, which isn't to say that they aren't true, but they're certainly, the sourcing is not quite as definitive as the sourcing for much of the rest of the book.
Bush-Cheney campaign spokesman Steve Schmidt said she's a discredited purveyor of trash.
For a discredited purveyor of trash, she sure sells a lot of books.
she's always consistently
on the best-selling list. And I think that's why the White House is working so hard to try to discredit her.
Apart from the specifics on George Bush or the cocaine allegation in particular, how does she characterize the sitting president, W?
She characterized him as sort of a hapless cut-up. I mean, the portrayal of the president is somebody who got into Yale University because he had father and grandfather and great-grandfather there, and then kind of frittered away his time there, and then drifted from job to job for many years, all of them obtained through his father's influence, until he finally had this conversion. So it's not an attractive picture. It's certainly not one that the White House wants to embrace. But I will say, as somebody who covers politics, I don't think it's necessarily a complete negative for the president. I've always thought that one of his appeals as a candidate is the sense that, hey, this was a guy who was a prodigal son, mm-hmm. and who did screw up and then turn things around. So there are some people who are going to look at this book and say, see, he's a screw up, he's hopeless. And there are other people who will say, see, he turned himself around. So I don't think it's going to change anybody's mind.
Even in the hands of Kitty Kelly, he may come out all right. Kathy, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Kathy Kiley is a reporter for USA Today. She spoke with me from Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.